University. Also, a longtime bluegrass musician was affectionately known as Banjo. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for two positions, a director of finance administration and a human resources manager. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Tarasena, Tommy Warren, Afterina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tim Riasti, Joe John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Honey Masood, and Adriana Contreras. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe, wear a mask, save lives.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Camera activist Betty Lee has captured 30 years of street protests in Portland, from the 1989 demonstration condemning the racist murder of Mulla Gaita Sirah to the Black Lives Matter protests of 2020. The Old Mole Variety Hour is pleased to offer a large print of your choice of Betty's most iconic photos to 10 lucky donors during KBOO's fall membership drive. Winners will be selected by lottery, and everyone who donates will be eligible. For more details and to see Betty's photos, go to kboo.fm/BETTELEE. Every Monday morning at 9 a.m., the Old Mole Variety Hour gnaws at the roots of our capitalist system with views, reviews, and interviews that you can sink your teeth into. Music by Lion Rhythms.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall fun drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, the deadline's fast approaching for some Oregon workers to get vaccinated or risk losing their jobs. A new pilot program aims at helping get emergency care to people in need in our community. And a big step forward toward boosters with another COVID-19 vaccine. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 14th, 2021. KBOO is currently in our fall fund drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks for joining us tonight. Thanks to two of Oregon's most influential unions, employees of the state executive branch facing next Monday's deadline for COVID-19 vaccinations are getting a six-week reprieve to attain full vaccination status. Liz Mara, press secretary for Governor Kate Brown, made the announcement earlier this week, saying the state has agreed to a process that allows employees represented by SEIU Local 503 and AFS CME Council 75, who will receive their first dose of COVID-19 vaccines, now have an extension until November 30th to get fully vaccinated. This agreement will affect approximately 26,800 workers to help them comply with the governor's mandate. On October 1st, an addendum to the statewide policy was issued granting the same grace period to 7,156 state employees not represented by a union or who fall under management or executive service. Spokespeople from Brown's office say this decision is more productive than having employees not receiving vaccinations at all and leaving state service. Union officials who pushed for the extension say many workers just wanted to be part of the conversation, citing concerns over vaccine side effects and general misinformation regarding vaccine hesitancy. Other bargaining tactics from the unions include citing busy schedules, making swift vaccinations difficult for many workers. This decision affects state departments, including the State Fire Marshal's Office, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, the Office of Emergency Management, and the Department of Environmental Control, among others. Similar negotiations are underway for unions representing police officers, firefighters, pharmacists, nurses, and other essential workers of state employees. Meantime, Multnomah County announces that 92% of its 5,600 employees have received their COVID-19 vaccinations just ahead of Monday's deadline, which Oregon Governor Kate Brown set for state and healthcare workers. Those statistics show that county workers' vaccination rates are higher than the county's population average. 7% of county employees received exemptions from vaccinations based on religious beliefs or medical exceptions. As of today, 72 county workers, or roughly 1% of the workforce, are not in compliance with the mandate, and they've been notified they will be laid off or terminated if they do not meet the October 18th deadline. County records show that only 26 of those in non-compliance are full-time employees, while the rest are temporary, on-call, or limited-duration employees. The City of Portland will be providing frequent updates on county workers' vaccinations as Monday approaches, with spokespeople saying vaccination is one of the best tools they have to limit the spread of COVID-19 and avoid serious illness. Multnomah County COO Serena Cruz says of the high numbers of workers in compliance, "I am really proud of this workforce's commitment to our community. The more of us that are vaccinated, the more lives that will be saved." It's an experiment, and if it works, local people in need will have better access to medical care when they need it in an emergency. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade explains what's going on with the CHAT pilot program.
On Wednesday, Portland City Council accepted a $2.5 million grant from CARE Oregon intended to fund a new response program for low-risk medical calls. The grant will support a 9-month pilot program that will be run by Portland Fire and Rescue called the Community Health Assess and Treat Program, or simply CHAT. With aims of improving medical care for people in need, CHAT will also cut healthcare costs and reduce the burden on the already strained emergency 911 system by offering a more efficient response to callers seeking low-risk medical assistance. Responders define low-risk medical calls as instances where people call 911 complaining of back pain, stomach pain, toothaches, falls, or from being generally unwell or sick. Under the new program, fire engines or ladder trucks and ambulances will not be dispatched for certain calls in downtown Portland and outer southeast Portland. A smaller team of 2 fire medics would respond to calls instead, evaluating individual patients' needs, providing basic medical services, and to help determine if the patient knows who their primary care provider is and how to contact them or help find them a medical provider. Portland firefighter Lisa Reslock, who is also a registered nurse at Legacy Emmanuel Medical Center, emphasized the growing need for responders to more efficiently assist patients, saying, quote, "It's extremely sad to be a first responder with a population that doesn't know how to access health care and see them not get the care they need," end quote. The money from CARE Oregon will fund CHAT with 23 positions, including administrative jobs aimed at establishing a new community health division within the Fire Bureau. Reslock will serve as the Bureau's Deputy Community Health Administrator. CHAT will also employ a roving critical care nurse for each team if fire medics require additional assistance at the scene. Set to start on November 15th, the 2-member fire team will be available from noon to 2 a.m., with responders checking back with patients 24 hours later to ensure proper care was facilitated and received. CARE Oregon anticipates the program will reduce unnecessary emergency room visits by at least 5%. Portland Fire Chief Sarah Boone says CHAT will help serve the disenfranchised, marginalized, elderly, and other vulnerable populations by having fire medics spend time with patients to better determine their individual needs instead of just sending them to hospitals in ambulances. Boone maintains the new program is intended to, quote, "help transform a healthcare system that tends to profit off people's sicknesses," end quote. With the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
During the pandemic, getting COVID vaccinations and medical care in general to the houseless community has been a struggle, according to Dr. Sharon Myron. The emergency doctor, who also serves as a Multnomah County commissioner, works to provide the houseless with medical care as a member of the Portland Street Medicine Group. She told fellow doctors at the Oregon Medical Association meeting more people need to step up and help.
We need to be working seamlessly together to make things work. And we can. I believe we can. We need to actually count who's living outside and understand who it is and have some data and outcome strategies, you know, to know where we're going, where we want to be, so we can work toward that effectively. Behavioral health is probably the biggest issue right now outside on our streets, and outreach and coordination. It has been awful. All providers that I talk to who do outreach on the streets have just seen such an escalation of the need, an escalation of the severity of some of the behavioral health issues that we've traditionally seen, but are so beyond the pale right now. And so we just need more things. I know things feel out of control to a lot of people I hear from as a commissioner, and they feel out of control to me as a provider seeing people living outside. It is, things are very challenging right now, and there are amazing organizations and people doing this work. And we need more to get resources to people living outside. And a shout out to Representative Lisa Reynolds, Dr. Lisa Reynolds, who has gone out with me to deliver services and supports to people during the unprecedented heat that we saw over the summer. And vaccines, there's not much going to the encampments, but there are groups like Outside In, I believe Central City Concerned. There are a lot of groups that will organize stations for people who are houseless to try to get vaccines, but we need to do so much better in that. There's not a way to coordinate. It makes it tough.
And that was Dr. Sharon Myron with the Portland Street Medicine Group. She is also a Multnomah County Commissioner. A big step forward for Moderna's booster dose of COVID-19 vaccine. The FDA's vaccine advisors have voted unanimously to recommend emergency use authorization for Moderna boosters for some people who are 6 months out from their first two shots. This would only be for people who are 65 and older, or those 18 to 64 who are at high risk of severe COVID-19 or whose exposure in their settings or jobs puts them at risk for severe illness. But members of the committee say they're not entirely convinced that a booster is necessary or that it will increase protection. Forests can play a big role in alleviating climate change threats. Forests, harvested wood products, and urban trees offset 11% of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States each year. Now, as Emily Scott reports, a new report aims at engaging outdoors enthusiasts like hunters and anglers in climate change solutions.
Few people spend as much time in the wilderness and outdoors as hunters and anglers. And a new report aims to be a springboard to bring those conservationists and their knowledge into discussions of combating climate change. The report, titled A Hunter's and Angler's Guide to Climate Change, touches on a variety of landscapes throughout the country used by sportsmen and women that face environmental threats. Among them are the country's forests and rivers. Report author Aaron Kindle of the National Wildlife Federation says in Colorado, heat waves, droughts, and forest fires are hurting outdoor recreation in the state.
If your elk hunt is canceled because the unit that you are going to hunt in is burning down, that's clearly an impact on the ability to hunt. We saw historic closures this year in Colorado. Many rivers closed because of too hot of temperatures for trout. So those are the kind of things we're seeing that are really meaning our ability to hunt and fish is under threat.
Colorado had its first 200,000-acre forest fire in 2020. The report says natural infrastructure can offer some level of protection for these areas. Wetlands, forests, and floodplains in particular can prevent flooding and help purify water. Kindle says some of the immediate actions hunters and anglers can take to start contributing to the fight against climate change include taking part in reforestation efforts. But a big part of finding environmental solutions is by advocating for resources on the state and federal level.
We are a community of storytellers. We talk about the hunt, we talk about fishing, we talk about the seasons and how they've changed. And hunters and anglers have such a crucial narrative that would help shape those pieces of legislation into a better form.
Among the federal support named in the report is the Replant Act, which would quadruple investments in reforestation in national forests. It also suggests relaunching the Civilian Conservation Corps, a 1930s public works program, but with a focus on addressing climate change. I'm Emily Scott with Colorado News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to a special fall fun drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can become a member or renew your KBOO membership at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on a community-led independent bottle redemption service born out of the pandemic. At 6 o'clock, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 8, Audio Pilot. Tonight's weather, mostly cloudy, down to 43. Tomorrow's weather, partly cloudy, a high around 65. The weekend's looking cloudy too, a high of 66 Saturday and 53 with showers possible on Sunday. Today in history, on this date in 1947, U.S. Air Force Captain Chuck Yeager broke the sound barrier, becoming the first person to fly faster than the speed of sound. The quote of the day is from Chuck Yeager, who said, "You do what you can for as long as you can. And when you finally can't, you do the next best thing. You back up, but you don't give up." More than 10,000 John Deere employees went on strike today. Their union says the company failed to present an agreement that met the needs and demands of its members. The United Auto Workers Union said its members are seeking an improved standard of living, retirement benefits, and a better work environment. A vast majority of about 90% rejected a tentative agreement that would have given 5 to 6% raises to the workers. The Biden administration addresses supply chain disruptions. The U.S. Supreme Court hears a death penalty appeal for a Boston Marathon bomber. And a Trump ally and former Justice Department employee face subpoenas from lawmakers. With more on these stories, here's today's edition of 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
This is the first key step toward moving our entire freight, transportation, and logistical supply chain nationwide to a 24/7 system.
President Biden announced Wednesday the Port of Los Angeles will begin 24/7 operations to address supply chain bottlenecks. He said the port has nearly doubled its hours of operation. A squeezed global supply chain and a truck driver shortage have led to shortages of computer chips, appliances, and other consumer goods, increasing price tags. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
These commitments will move more goods faster, including toys, just in case you were wondering, appliances, my kids are, and furniture that Americans purchased online or at their local small businesses.
Vice President Kamala Harris met Wednesday with the Prime Minister of Barbados, Mia Motley, who talked about strengthening the Caribbean region's relationship with the U.S. on climate change, combating drug trafficking, and human rights.
There is much that we can work together on, looking to see where both countries can help each other. We have traditionally provided persons who have come here to work.
The Supreme Court Wednesday appeared poised to reinstate a death sentence for Jahar Tsarnaev, convicted of helping carry out the 2013 Boston Marathon bombings. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer.
They agreed he was guilty. Their only claim was, don't give me the death penalty because it's my brother who is the moving force.
The U.S. Court of Appeals in Boston upheld Tsarnaev's convictions, but ruled his death sentence could be overturned because the trial judge had not questioned the jurors closely enough about their exposure to pretrial publicity and excluded evidence concerning Tamerlan Tsarnaev, his older brother and accomplice. A House committee investigating the January 6th Capitol attack subpoenaed Jeffrey Clark, a Trump ally and former Justice Department employee, who urged its leaders to investigate former President Trump's election fraud claims. Experts say the move indicates the committee's interest in learning more about how Trump attempted to pressure top officials over the election during his final days in office. Dr. Anthony Fauci, President Biden's chief medical advisor, said Wednesday more employers should implement vaccine mandates.
I mean, we don't like to be telling people what they need to do with regard to vaccines, but we know that mandates work.
Two new analyses suggest the 2020 census may have undercounted Black Americans at a significantly higher rate than usual, anywhere from 3 to 10 times greater than a decade ago, raising concerns about whether minority communities could lose out on fair representation and funding. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Racial justice advocates say practices used in redistricting often prevent communities of color from having an equal voice. Mike Moen explains how the debate is playing out in Minnesota.
A special court panel is hosting public hearings this month, asking Minnesotans what new political maps should look like. Racial justice advocates worry lack of engagement might not compel enough BIPOC residents to testify. Five judges appointed by the state Supreme Court are overseeing a redistricting process separate from what the politically divided legislature is doing. If lawmakers can't agree on maps, the court's plans would get the nod. Monica Maria Hurtado with Voices for Racial Justice says she was puzzled by the low attendance at the Minneapolis hearing this week. She wonders if the importance of redistricting isn't conveyed to communities of color as much as it should be.
The community, the regular citizen, in this type of process is still not as friendly, is not as participatory as I wish it could be and it should be.
She also notes that some people who signed up to testify but didn't show might have encountered scheduling conflicts. She says the good news is that the panel will still accept written testimony until October 29th. As for the hearings, which also can be viewed online, they're scheduled to run through the 26th. Details are posted on the Minnesota Judicial Branch website. The redrawing of legislative and congressional boundaries happens each decade after a formal census count to ensure equal representation. Hurtado and fellow advocates say this time around they want communities of interest to be a key principle in any new map.
Consider the interests of communities of color and not to divide communities of color who are trying to develop businesses, to develop areas.
Voices for Racial Justice is part of a coalition that recently filed a court petition asking for more consideration of BIPOC communities in redistricting. Minnesota's deadline for enacting new political maps is February 15th. In recent decades, the courts have often intervened due to legislative stalemates. Mike Moen, Minnesota News Connection. Find our rate trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The Association of Indigenous Anthropologists wants to take another look at Native land acknowledgments. And the CEO of Minnetonka Footwear Company apologizes for appropriating and profiting from Native culture. With these stories and more, here's National Native News, the daily report dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamrick in for Antonia Gonzalez. Acknowledging Native land has become a way for institutions and individuals to honor the land's original inhabitants. But now a group says land acknowledgments may be doing more harm than good. The Mountain West News Bureau's Madeline Beck explains.
The Association of Indigenous Anthropologists wants a hiatus of land acknowledgments. That is, statements about how a business or university's land once belonged to Native groups. Richard Myers is the upcoming president of that association and works at Oglala Lakota College in South Dakota. He says acknowledgement is good, but can also be a fallback that lacks real change.
It doesn't really dig at the heart of the matter of what's going on. What are the inequities and the injustices? And instead, let's just give this as a saving face moment to move forward.
Meyer says South Dakota State University has gone further, putting money earned from its land ownership towards Native student education. But he says we need to give tribal and Indigenous groups power to make decisions over the land. For National Native News, I'm Madeline Beck.
In Seattle this week, several tribes and their supporters protested peacefully against dams built by the city's public utility. King 5 News reported the dams built by Seattle City Light to generate hydropower do not allow fish to get around the structures. Natural resource regulators across the Northwest and scientists for the three tribes protesting the dams say this is killing salmon by blocking access to habitat. City Light has denied their dams impact salmon, but the Upper Skagit Indian Tribe, the Sauk-Suwatl Tribe, and the Swinomish tribes say the dams put their treaty rights at risk. The tribes handed over their land in the 19th century in exchange for fishing rights, but now three of the salmon species on the Skagit River are on the endangered species list. In July, the Sauk-Suwatl sued the city of Seattle over the dams. A number of tribes attended the protest this week from across the country to show solidarity, including the Standing Rock Sioux, the Lummi, and the San Carlos Apache. Ramona Bennett of the Puyallup tribe in Washington told King 5 News the salmon need these advocates.
The salmon don't have cell phones. They can't call a legislator. They can't call anyone for help. It's up to us. We have to be their voice.
The utility is undergoing a federal relicensing process and says it's studying the possibility of installing a fish passage system. The head of the Minnetonka Footwear Company apologized this week for appropriating and profiting from Native culture and says it's working to change its practices. NPR reported CEO David Miller used the occasion of Indigenous Peoples Day to make his apologies and pledge to help Native communities. Minnetonka launched in 1946, selling moccasins and, quote, Native-inspired accessories in retail shops. Minnetonka is known for its moccasins, and Miller acknowledged that even the phrase was appropriated from an anglicized Ojibwe word. It redesigned its logo in 2008 to take that word out, but he says the moccasins remain a core part of the Minnetonka brand. The company is working with Adrian Benjamin as a reconciliation advisor who is Anishinaabe and a member of the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe. She's an artist and community activist. In a blog she wrote for the company, Benjamin notes that since much of Minnetonka's wealth comes from cultural appropriation, it should invest back into the communities from which it stole. She writes, "That must come first." The company plans to collaborate with Native designers moving forward and recruit more talent from Native American and other underserved communities. It also plans to seek out partnerships with Native-owned businesses and contribute to Native American organizations in Minnesota and beyond. For National Native News, I'm Megan Kamrick.
Texas has more registered firearms than any state in the nation. That fact has people asking whether lenient laws are tied to the latest school shooting. Roz Brown takes a look.
Texas has some of the weakest gun laws in America, and gun control advocates say that permissive attitude may be why a student took a gun to school last week that led to a shooting that injured four people. A Texas law took effect September 1st, allowing residents who are 21 years of age or older to carry handguns in public without a license. The Arlington High School student involved in the shooting was 18. Brady United Against Gun Violence President Chris Brown says it's alarming that once again, back to school has meant back to school shootings.
This is a uniquely American epidemic, and as a parent, I'm disgusted that we continue to live this way.
On November 3rd, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear oral arguments in a major Second Amendment case that centers on whether the Constitution guarantees the right to carry guns outside the home. Brown says between August 1st and September 15th, there have been at least 30 instances of gunfire on school grounds, killing five and wounding more than 20 people.
The culture is, well, of course, the way to solve conflicts is to bring a gun. And we have solutions to this sitting before us, and we're not acting on them.
While the permitless carry law easily passed the Texas legislature, Brown notes that police associations were opposed.
It's law enforcement across the state of Texas who were most vocal in saying, please don't overturn the permitting system that has worked really well.
The number of shootings in Texas, not including suicides, increased 14% this year, according to data compiled by the Gun Violence Archive. For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to a special fall fund drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 14th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, Roz Brown, Mike Moen, and Emily Scott. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Native Voice One and Public News Service. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. KBOO is on our fall fund drive, which means that now is a great time to become a member and support your local community radio station. If you would like to contribute to KABU, you can go to kabu.fm/give or text KABU to 44321. Stay tuned now for a report on the People's Depot, a community-led independent bottle redemption service born out of the pandemic.
Thank you.